So thank you very much, Will, for introduction and also for inviting me. So can everyone hear me in the back? Or shall I move my microphone?
It's good.
So is it good?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. So I did my PhD in Vancouver, Canada. So, you know, I have a very strong emotional attachment to Canada. So I think Canada is the best. It's good to be back. What Will didn't tell you about my PhD is that I did a theoretical work, and I did a lot of stochastic modeling, you know, mainly applying the statistical mechanics to biological phenomena. And my thesis advisor, John Becoffer, was an experimentalist. So my path in the last, 10 years has not quite been an orthodox, you know, physicist. And my research basically reflects my, you know, the path. So let me just ask you one quick question. So how many of you are biologists or took the biology classes since high school? Very good. Okay. Okay, so I feel better. Before I start, you know, I made one terrible mistake. I didn't realize that the black background is not very good. Some of the movies and the pictures won't be as clear as you know, I see on my screen, but I hope I'll do my best, okay, to convey my message. So the title of my talk is Chromosome Cell Cycle and Entropy. And if this doesn't make sense to you at all, that's totally okay. And then, because when I heard one of my favorite movies titled "The Sex, Lies, and Videotape," you know, I had the same question. So let me tell you up front. The story I'm going to tell you is about one of the long-standing problems in biology, and you may wonder why, you know, the physicists should bother. And there are basically two schools. In the first school is about, you know, there are proteins, and basically the chromosome segregation in bacteria and, you know, higher eukaryotes, virtually every cell should be driven by some biological mechanisms, okay? And the second school is small minor school, is that there are some very fundamental physics going on there. My view now, so I'm responsible for the second school, and my view now is that the views should be reconciled, but my talk will be on the second part. Okay, then I'll touch base on the how we can actually put everything together later. So this is E. coli. This is the organism that I study, that I love very much. And then I don't intend this slide to be a lecture on biology. Rather, what I want you to get out of this slide is just the complexity of these small cells. So the typical, so the size of this E. coli has a length scale of 1 micron, okay? And this E. coli can swim, and it grows and divides, and there are a lot of incredible things happen. And inside this cell, there are about millions of proteins, and the proteins are these small, I don't know whether you can see this well, small the biomolecules. They do a lot of work during the cell cycle. And the length scale of those particles that about nanometers can be tens of nanometers as well, okay? So about 100 to 1,000 times smaller than the size of this, the width of this E. coli cell. Inside, there's a genetic material, okay, the chromosomes, and this DNA, once you take out and completely stretch it, it is as long as 1 millimeter. So again, it's like 1,000 times longer than the length of this E. coli. And of course, no biomolecule, your random walk is not stretched, meaning that the radius of gyration over unconfined DNA, the chromosome, is about the tens of 10 microns. So if this is E. coli, you take this chromosome out of the cells, and you just let it relax. And then the size of the chromosome should be about the size of this screen, so even larger. Okay? So it's extremely complex, and there are many molecules characterized by different length scales. Okay? So this is just the zoom in of part of this E. coli, inside of E. coli, and then and these guys are the ribosomes, for instance, and they're protein complexes. They are the complexes of proteins that make proteins, and the size is like 20 nanometers. And this blue The yellow lines are the DNA. So this particular cartoon was drawn something like 10 years ago. The guy, the David Kusler, was trying to be as faithful as the experimental data. We now know that some of these depiction is kind of misleading. But anyways, the point is that the DNA is a very thin noodle, extremely long. So if you look at this E. coli under the microscope, it's like this. You start with the one cell, they grow at a constant rate, and divides and grows and divides and grows and divides and so on. Okay? So I'll come back to you later about this, the movie and the picture later on. So now this is the highly simplified, almost a spherical cow, view of a bacterial cell cycle. And then there's a famous remark by my personal hero, François Jacob, who once said, the dream of every cell is to become two cells. And despite all the complexity, the basic processes are very simple. We have a genetic material. It has to replicate. So a small replication bubble occurs like this, and which grows bidirectionally. One thing I forgot to tell you is that the topology of a bacterial genome is typically circular like this. It's a closed ring, highly compressed inside the cells. Anyway, so once replication starts, this bubble grows bidirectionally, changing the topology and as well as the geometry of the chromosomes. And then in the meantime, cell grows. And for whatever reasons, the chromosomes segregate while replicating, and by the mechanism which we don't really understand, which is the topic of this talk. And then once replicated genomic materials are separated, the cell divides in the middle. And then one cell becomes two cells. So the time scale of these whole processes are typically tens of minutes. Okay, depending on the growth rate, can be slower, but the cell can divide as fast as every 20 minutes. And the replication takes 40 minutes. It sounds, if it doesn't make sense to you, it's okay. I'll come back to that at the end of my talk, why there is a problem. So the François Jacob also is the one who proposed the first model on chromosome segregations. And his model is very elegant and beautiful, and it's as follows. We start with the one circular chromosomes, and the ori is original replication. That is the first point along the chromosome where replication starts. And that ori was believed to be tethered to the inner cell wall membrane like this. And then soon after the onset of replication, the duplicated ori is tethered in the inner cell wall membrane like that. And because the cell grows all the time, and then the cell wall synthesis is everywhere, the elongation of the growing cell can passively or actively pull the replicating DNA as well. So this is the simplest and then, but from my point of view, most beautiful model of segregation. The only problem with this model is that it doesn't agree with the experimental data. So, and here is the one direct experimental evidence that why the Jacob's model cannot be right. So this, in the last 10 years or so, biologists have developed a lot of techniques so that we can actually visualize the specific position along the chromosomes using fluorescent microscopy. So in this particular experiment, the model organism used is the Colobacter crescentus, which is like E. coli, about the size of the E. coli, and then it's also rod-shaped, but it's like a banana. It's like it's a crescentus, that's the where the name comes from. And so that ori of that genome, the first point to be replicated, is typically localized at this pole, cell pole like that. What is striking in this organism is that the as soon as the ori is replicated, the replicated ori shows fast, relatively fast directed motion like that. So during the course of about 20 minutes or so, cell does not grow very much, but the ori moves all the way from one pole to the other. So if the Jacob's model was right, the elongation rate of the cell and the movement rate of ori should be more or less comparable. And then now we know that the motion of DNA can be completely independent of the growth of the cells. That's why the model is, has been proven wrong. And there are a bunch of other experimental results, but fundamentally, this is more or less the story. Now, one may wonder why this DNA shows this kind of directed motions. So one popular view is that there are some protein machineries which actually comes from the eukaryote high organisms, such as human cells, there must be protein machineries which pulls and pushes actively the DNA around inside the cells. Okay? That is not my view, and because I think there's a fundamental the problem with that view. I won't go into too much details, but here what you see is the typical cartoon from the biology textbook. So these are the pair of duplicated chromosomes. In humans, for example, have 23 pairs of like this. And then they're waiting to be separated, and they're in two bipolar positions. There are protein machineries, and this so-called the microtubules and those spindles grow, and they fish around this pair of chromosomes. Once the spindle attaches one side of the chromosomes, and once all this pairing is done, then they retract, and then pulls apart, they pull apart the replicate chromosomes. So people imagine this kind of view, even in bacteria, to explain the directed motions of a DNA during the cell cycle. What you should realize, however, is that in this case, the size of the cell is typically about like this. Well, about the size of this screen, okay, in eukaryotic cells. In bacteria, as I told you, if you take out the chromosomes, as I will show you in our experiments, they occupy much larger volume, meaning that these bacterial chromosomes experience very strong confinement. So if you have two duplicated chromosomes, they have a natural tendency of occupying as much volume as possible inside the cells. So the first question that came to my mind was that when I started working on these problems, why shouldn't they mix? Each chromosome is strongly confined. Why don't they occupy just the entire cell and then completely mixing with each other? Okay? So that's where the story of entropy comes from. So let me show you one simple molecular dynamics simulations, and everybody knows this example. So I have this rectangular box, and then I separated these particles by a wall in between, and they're exactly the same particles. The only difference is just the colors. Okay, I let them go through these Brownian motions, and then I soon remove the wall, and everybody knows what is going to happen, and all these particles should mix. Okay, and then because this is the entropy of mixing. And this entropy of mixing, so this view is consistent with the the view in the early 20th century when the statistical mechanics was just beginning, was being explored by many people. And then, so that also bothered the Erwin Schrödinger a lot. So I'm sure you know Schrödinger, and then as a founder, one of the founders of quantum mechanics. But if you actually talk to biologists, they will remember him differently. And he's known for his book, What is Life? And it's not about philosophy. And if you look at the subtitle of the title, the physical aspect of the living cell. In fact, he spent a lot of significant part of his career thinking about the cells and actually how he can make sense out of the biological processes from physics point of view. It really bothered him. In the last chapter, he said, does the living organism continually increases its entropy to approach the dangerous state of maximum entropy, which is of death? Okay, so, and what he didn't know was just soft condensed matter physics, because the polymer physics, for example, in the 1940s was really in the infant stage, and then we know now, water can actually emerge out of disorder because of entropy, like in a phase transition, liquid crystals, and so on. So what I'm actually going to do, so imagine, I'm not going to play the movie again. Now, let's start with the completely mixed state of the two particles. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to connect all these particles such that I start with two completely intermingled, one giant red chain and one giant the blue chain, like this, okay? And then I let just them go through these Brownian motions again, and something completely different happens, okay? It's about, in 20 seconds or so, the two chains will, the segregate. And this is the actual real Brownian, dynamic simulations. And, if you're in just undergrad, for example, you can actually write a code to simulate something like this. So I strongly encourage you to have fun with this. So if you think about it, and there's no real difference between this system and the system I just showed you before. And then the only difference really is that I introduced the chain connectivity. And then something completely different happens. the chain connectivity is the key word in polymer physics, and then a lot of counterintuitive things happen. So if there are biologists here, you know, knowing this kind of things, if you know this kind of things, you will start asking different kinds of questions of the same in a system you're looking at. So that's your take-home message, one of the take-home messages I wanted to, you know, convey. So why do they really, you know, not mix? Why do they segregate? So it's actually very simple to understand. To give you an intuitive explanation, imagine I, on a piece of paper, draw this kind of a self-forwarding random walk, okay? So, you know, so it's the random walk that the path does not cross its own path, okay? Now try to draw a second chain such that, like this, such that, you know, you'd walk the same amount of walk, but the center position of the two chains would be completely overlapping, okay? And if you try to draw such a chain, you'll find it very challenging. And this is all because of the self-avoidance as well as the chain connectivity. Now, if you try to draw the second chain just outside the first chain like that, it's much easier. Here, what I'm trying to describe is essentially that the conformational space occupied by two separate chains is much larger than the two chains overlapping. Okay? So in other words, this is an argument of entropy or conformational entropy. What is non-trivial is that the free energy cost or the amount of entropy you have to pay, the entropy cost you have to pay to make two chains completely overlap is actually independent of the size of the chain. So if you double the length of this chain and then do the same for the red and you try to, you know, make them overlap, and then you'd pay exactly the same amount of free energy cost, okay? And that is naturally very high. It's just order of KT. So in dilute solutions, two chains, self-forwarding chains can overlap relatively easily, not completely, you know, easily, but if you rely on thermal fluctuations, it can happen fairly often. And also, if you try to make the three chains and four chains and general n number of chains overlap, the free energy increase is not linear. The third chain costs a lot more than the overlapping two chains and so on for the fourth chain as well, okay? So so then how do you understand the segregation of chromosomes? So this is the, usually I explain how I explain using the piston analogy. So imagine a long cylindrical tube, initially completely open, and then you put this self-opening chain inside this tube. The first thing that happens is that this chain stretches out, and as Jen, I would say that it breaks into conceptual units of blobs, like this. And each blob behaves essentially as an independent chain. And this long chain can be understood as a string of blobs, which is linearly stretched out like that. Okay? Now I close this my chain, my cylinder, with the two pistons, and I compress it. And first, these chains will touch one another, but if I continue compressing the whole system, and the blobs initially will overlap. But as I just told you, blobs don't like each other. Okay, they don't like to, you know, overlap, so they will repel. Okay? And you can continue this process for a while. But this segregation of two chains, because the blob-blob repulsion does not last indefinitely. Okay, so because the reason is as follows. Just imagine a system of a gas, you know, a volume V. If you reduce the volume of your box containing van der Waals gas, for example, you will know that the pressure increases. So one of the answers in polymer physics is that free energy stored in a chain is proportional to the total number of blobs. So one blob stores 1 kT. So because the total free energy increases, and the total number of blobs should also increase as well. But now, because we have a smaller total volume, the only way to make the whole, you know, picture consistent is that the number, size of blobs should decrease. And as I said, the free energy stored in a blob is KT, and it is independent of the size of the blobs. So look at the conformation of individual chains here. Now the conformation is that of a string of blobs as well. And then when the compression is too high, the whole system gains more conformational entropy by mixing them, by doing random walk inside this chain, okay? Now, you can actually translate the whole thing into a rigorous phase diagram, and you need to know the three parameters. The first one is the typical length scale that characterizes your confinement. In this case, for example, it would be the width of this, the cylinder. And then a second parameter to need to know is that the size of the chains in the absence of confinement. So you take out this blue chain, for example, and it occupies this much volume, and then the size is this RG, radius of gyration. And the last in the parameter, the third parameter you need to know is the size of the blobs, which is essentially the correlation length of the system. And then the whole phase diagram can be divided into two regions. This blue is where two chains in confinement repel one another, and they're also individually ordered. And this red region is where two chains are intermingle. And the x-axis is the degree of confinement, because the ratio of this, the size of the chain outside the channels, and then the size of this confinement gives you the degree of confinement. And the y-axis is the chain of concentration, chain concentration, because the correlation length is a function of the density of the chains inside the box. So the question is, where is E. coli? So fortunately for E. coli, the all three parameters have been measured, and then RG is something like between 5 and 10 microns, and D is the width of the E. coli cells, which is about 1 micron, or 0.5 to 1 micron. And correlation length is much more difficult to measure, but recently the fluorescent correlation spectroscopy techniques allowed us to measure that. So that is about the 100 nanometers. So E. coli actually belongs to this regime. This is where individual chains are strongly compressed. But still, because of entropic regions, the chains do not mix one another. One thing I didn't tell you is that the chromosome is not the only DNA inside the cells. There are other types of DNA called the plasmids, and then you can just think of it as a kind of 100 chromosomes, which is just 100 times smaller. Okay, and so because they are so small, their contribution to the total amount of DNA inside the cell is negligible. And also, the size of the cell doesn't change. So the only case, the only parameter that changes for plasmid, this small DNA, is just the radius of the gyrations. And because the control length is like 100 times smaller, the radius of the gyration is something like 10 times smaller. What that means is that you slide this chromosome along the y equals x axis by 1 over the magnitude, and that's where plasmid is. So if you have a small circles of DNA, they have a natural tendency of mixing or just distributed randomly. So in nature, we know that the plasmids do not really, the cells do not lose plasmids. That means there must be some kind of strategy. And then there are two strategies in nature. One is that these plasmids make many, many copies of themselves so that they rely on random segregations. Or when they don't have the ability to make many copies, they actually rely on active segregation mechanism, which is like a spindle-like mechanism I showed you at the beginning of my talk. So it seems that, as far as the theory is concerned, we can actually explain why bacterial chromosomes should demix spontaneously driven by conformational entropy. Now, if you talk to biologists, you will immediately realize that the theory does not have a very the high position. So they often do not respect the theory, and which is understandable because it is the complexity of the real biological system that makes everything so difficult. Okay, so there was skepticism about the spherical cow picture. So that was the story I just told you. Is what I did something like four or five years ago, and that is around the time I also faced a lot of challenges from biologists. So the only way to convince them or to convince myself is that we got to do experiments. And because I was a theoretician, I came up with a totally unrealistic experiments to do like this. So the idea was something like this, where so we can build small channels like this, and this is a microfluidic the device, where the dimensions would be something like the size of the cells. And then we can take a chromosomes, and you put the chromosomes inside this device, and then we have optical traps, and essentially we would explore the phases of the diagram I showed you, the Pearson analogy I showed you in reality. So, and it's difficult to find when you have this kind of crazy the project to do your work. And then unfortunately, it was Harvard who just decided to invest in me. So I built, this is when around time Will visited my lab, and I was starting from the empty space. And the postdocs don't want to do risky projects. OK. Okay, I don't know whether, I don't think that's true in physics, but certainly it is in biology. And the kind of people I was, you know, I managed to convince to do this project, including myself, was the undergrad. And he's actually older than this. And a very naive, brilliant but naive grad students, or some crazy physicist who don't quite understand, you know, biology very much. So we thought that we can do this. And it took us a long time. And this is the experimental design. Now we went through many, many revisions. And this is what it came up with. So we would build this kind of long channels where the width and depth would be something like 1 micron. And the length is something like tens of microns. And we'd build thousands of them because I wanted to do this in a high throughput way. And then we'd connect these guys to the long main trench where the length is something like 3 centimeters. And then the depth and the width are something like 100 microns and 50 microns. And this is a top view. And we built it. So we have to put the chromosomes into the channels. Okay. And how do we do it? Initially, I was going to put the chromosomes, obtain the chromosomes outside the device and put them into the device. But it was not very easy. And in the end, this is how we obtain our chromosomes. So we load the cells to the device, to the micro piston channels. And then we flush with a lot of high concentration of a solute. And because of this huge difference in the osmolarity, the water rushes out of the cells. And that somehow perturbs the inner cell wall membrane. So the inner cell wall membrane detaches from the cell wall. And then we add enzymes called the lysozyme, which looks like this Pac-Man-looking guys. And they enter the cells, and they digest the cell wall material. Once that is done, we wash all these guys away. And then the difference of osmolarity reverses. And then the pressure is much higher. So the water rushes in. And then a chromosome comes out. So in the next movie, I'm going to show you the very last step. So this is supposed to look better than this. But anyway, so you can see the fluorescent the objects. So these green objects are the cells. In fact, what you're looking at are the chromosomes stained with the green fluorescent proteins. Okay. And there are channels. That looks something like this. So these are the dead ends of the piston channels, and these are the open ends. Okay, and this is the main trench where there will be the flow of a shock buffer. So this is how we do it. We infuse shock buffer, and you will see the chromosomes coming out of the cells. Okay, and if you look at these guys, he will escape. So the sliding is much clearer on my screen, but I take my word. So that's why we know that the wall has very low friction. So the chromosomes really do not stick to the walls like this. Okay, and of course we are a group of physicists, and that we know how to analyze this kind of thing. So for instance, this is we measure the intensity profile along the long axis of the channels, and we know how long the chromosomes are, and this is what the typical data looks like. So x axis is the time during the lysis process, and y axis the length of the chromosomes during expansions. Okay, and if you look at the second trajectory, it looks like that, and then if you plot all the trajectories, though they show more or less the characteristic shape. So we interpreted it as a simple model that, what if we have an entropic spring, highly compressed, and then initially compressed, and we let them release, expand in a viscous medium. And this is you can write down the simple theory, and then using this expression solution, you can fit your the data, and then the data is actually on the near side. And also, if you look at this expression carefully, you will know that the whole thing can be basically rescaled using the length of the equilibrium length, which is the final length of the chains inside the droplet. And if you do that, the whole thing, all this trajectory should collapse onto a single master curve. Okay, so there's the characteristic length scale, and there's the characteristic the time scale. So the characteristic time scale of expansion is something like tens of seconds. which is about two orders of magnitude smaller than the cell cycle of the bacteria. So the, whenever we see separation of length scales or time scales, which is a good sign, because the, you know, theory can be much can be very simplified, and something is much faster than the other. In this case, the entropic the expansion of the chromosomes by entropic forces can be much, much faster than the typical time scale of the cell cycle. So since we know how to obtain the chromosomes, then we will do the next steps. So we will compress these guys. So so this is just a schematic, one of the cartoons I showed you previously. And this is, again, the same microfluidic device. Now, after the expansions, once we obtain the chromosomes, we add the microbeads. Okay? And so in this case, this is the fluorescently labeled the chromosomes, and there's a microbead here. Okay? The quality is not very good because of some technical reasons. And then during the experiment, we actually do not watch our chromosomes like this. This is for pure, you know, the visualization purposes. So now we can actually compress these chromosomes. So this is combination with a single molecule manipulation techniques and the microfluidics device. And then we compress the chromosomes, and we come out of the other channels, and then we compress again. And we can repeat this many, many times. Okay? And this is what the, so in the experiment, you know, we know exactly where this bead position is, end of the channels is, and then we can measure the chromosome length, and we apply the force using optical traps, which is essentially just, you know, hook and spring, and this is what the data looks like. So let me just zoom in, this is much better. So what you do is that the, we push the beads to a certain distance, delta X, and then the force changes accordingly. So there's some relaxation, the period processes, but eventually the force calms down. And then we can translate the whole thing into this kind of force versus chromosome length, the curves. So people in biophysics, you know, used to stretch the, you know, things, like a DNA or whatever. And then this is the first case we actually compress, we do the something reverse. We compress our chromosomes. Different channels show different curves like this, but if there's a universality, and namely, if the whole system can be characterized by some length scale, which is the length of the equilibrium, you know, chromosomes, then, again, they collapse like this. And again, using the simple theory we wrote a couple of years ago, you know, we can explain the our data, which is kind of surprising because our model assumes we have a simple bead connected, and there's a self-avoidance. And then this is the data is from the real chromosomes. So there's no a priori reason to believe that you know, we should be able to explain the data using simple theory. So the message from here is that the bacterial chromosomes seems to behave like loaded entropic springs, okay? And despite the strong compression, two chains inside the cell do not mix each other because of a conformational entropy. And there's a natural tendency of demixing. It's a primordial driving force for chromosome segregations. And because the robust nature of physical principles in general, we think this principle should apply to a wide range of organisms, from early life to higher eukaryotes. So let me just touch one of the cases. So this is here from the review article, a perspective article by Jack Jostock and colleagues who won actually the Nobel Prize the last year in chemistry or maybe medicine. So he was envisioning the cell cycle of very early life at the very, very beginning of the evolution. Okay? So his vision was that everything started from the membrane, and this membrane incorporates a lipid, which can grow, and because of small fluctuations, this growing and perturbed membrane can divide into two. So this is very, a primitive version of a cell cycle. So my proposal is that if you add polymers inside, like a very primitive form of genetic materials, because of entropic repulsions between these primitive chromosomes, you can really enhance this kind of processes. Okay, for instance, here, if the two chains repel one another, it would enhance the deforming of the other chains, as well as it would regulate the size of the individual the cells. And this is not pure scientific fantasies, because we actually tried something fun. So I don't know whether you can see this clearly. So, well, what you should imagine is that this is immersion. So this is the oil drop, and containing bacterial, isolated bacterial chromosomes, which are fluorescently labeled. So we didn't push too far, but this was clear, you know, from this experiment, it was clear that we can probably really mimic this kind of processes in the lab. Okay? So this is a good part to make a transition to the last part of my talk. So there's something I didn't tell you at the beginning when I was talking about this bacterial cell cycle. It turns out that bacteria have two internal clocks. Okay, so one clock basically measures how often the cell should grow and how often the cell should divide. And the second clock measures when to start cell cycle. And these two clocks are not independent from each other. For example, if the division is too faster, then the cell cycle, then you'd end up with a lot of chromosomes inside the cell. Or if the division is much, much slower than the duration of a cell cycle, then you'll end up with all these empty cells. So these two clocks somehow coordinated, and then exactly how that is done is completely unknown in biology. And I think this is one of the problems that actually physics can contribute. I won't go into details, but you know, I'm happy to talk to you after this talk. So what can happen is that if the cell grows very fast because you give them a lot of good food, and in fact they can create this kind of very complex topology of the chromosomes. So in the end, understanding all these processes and then at the higher level really requires understanding how the cell knows its own size. Okay, so we realized that we can actually use our micropiston to address eventually this kind of questions. And what we started doing was to actually grow cells. So I told you we load the cells to the our channels like this. Okay, and then we take out the chromosomes. Instead of killing the cells to obtain the chromosomes, we can actually provide the nutrient. Okay, and so that the cells can actually grow. The advantage of this is that we can really follow who is the mother, who is the daughter, and who is the cousin. So we can actually construct the lineage trees very, very clearly, as long as the cells are alive. So, and this is how we do the experiments. Okay. And each channel typically contains tens of cells. And they're growing at 37°C, very healthy. And it just, the cells are expressing fluorescent proteins. That's how we can actually monitor these cells. And the interval of this movie is at 1 minute. So there's 1 minute between the two frames, okay? And again, we are physicists, tend to be a quantitative, and this is how we analyze our data. If you just look at the one channel, look at it. Okay, and this is how the intensity profiles along the channel looks like. So one line here corresponds to one snapshot. And then we follow the cells for something like 4,000 minutes. So because we take pictures every minute, there are 4,000 pictures like that. So there are, in fact, this is a montage of the 4,000 lines like that. And this is the level of fluorescence of individual cells. That tells you about the level of protein synthesis or its activity, which is more or less constant. And although it shows fluctuations, so that is intrinsic stochasticity of the cell inactivity of the cell. And this is the length of the length versus time. So cell probably can't see this very well, but it looks like the zigzag. So the cell grows and divides and grows and divides. And sometimes you see this kind of a spike, and it's because the particular cell we are looking at failed to divide. So it grows and grows and grows. And eventually, they often divide again. And when they divide, they go back to their normal size. Somehow, the cell knows what size it should be, but we don't. Okay, so that's one of the main problems we have in biology. And just to give you an idea of why this is important, this tool. And at the beginning, I showed you this growing colony of E. coli, right? You started one cell, and then its area increases exponentially. And when you do experiments like that, you can typically follow something like 10 generations, which gives you about 1,024 cells. And once you have 1,000 cells, and it saturates the entire field of view, so you can't, basically you lose track of your cells. In our device, you can do this for hundreds of generations, well, actually until the cell dies. And this is just to give you an idea that it's very high throughput experiment. So this is a typical experiment, and this is not the best movie, and this is really the typical the movie from any experiments we do. Okay? So in this case, we have 12 fields of view, and within 1 minute, we scan around our microfluidic devices. Okay? As a result, what it can do is that we can obtain all those magnitude amounts of data, and because we know how to analyze data quantitatively, and basically we have access to unlimited, the amounts of data and information of the growing cells, okay, that is unparalleled in biology so far. So just, we have a lot of information. I can tell you a lot of stories, but I'll tell you only one thing. So what we've learned from this experiment is that for hundreds of generations, over 200 generations, the elongation rate of E. coli does not decrease. It's very, very constant. So somehow, the E. coli cells know how to maintain its speed of growth, okay? And if you plot other quantities, like size distributions, or level of fluorescence, or the duration of a cell cycles, and so on, they're all more or less constant, okay? And then the cell, when it divides, it forgets how fast it was growing. And then that we know because we can plot the autocorrelation function of the growth rate and so on. So this robust nature of a mechanism of growth is something very remarkable. And I think it explains how the cell maintains this robust, the cell cycle. Because if the growth is robust, cell cycle must be robust. Chromosome segregation must be robust. All these fundamental processes must be very robust. And then we just begin to understand what the nature of those robustness and of these biological processes. And that's what you are doing these days. So I was told that I should finish before 5, otherwise people start to get nervous. And then I have only one more slide that is slightly philosophical. So why do we bother? In the end, I was a theoretical physicist, and why, I decided to, work at the bench, doing some cloning and then, learning some E. coli genetics. And I guess everyone who has gone through a similar path like myself has his or her own reason for this kind of conversion. In my case, it goes back to my lessons from the history of science. So some 500 years ago, Tycho Brahe, I'm sure all of you know, went to the roof every night and he measured the position of the stars very, very carefully in a very rigorous way. And in the sense, he was the first modern scientist because he believed in the rigor of data collection. And then good data, rigorous data, are the starting point of scientific breakthrough. And the story goes as follows. And he collected all this data, and then despite he relied on his data, this is his view of the universe, okay? And he got the order of the planets right, so there's Earth and the Mars and so on and so forth, but the orbit was kind of circular, and then the biggest problem was that at the center of the universe, there was the sun. Because within the precision of data, he was able to explain his data using epicycles, that how the Earth can go around the sun, as well as the rest of the planets. And this is postdoc, Johannes Kepler. When Tycho Brahe died, he took the data, the lab book of Tycho Brahe, and he studied that for 30 years. And he came up with his famous three the principles, that the orbit of the planets are actually the ellipse, not the circular, and then here this angular momentum conservation and so on and so forth. And that is a phenomenology based on the data, and he came up with a quantitative the model which made possible to predict what is going to happen to the position of the planets. But as you know, we had to wait another 50 years in the history of science to wait for Newton. And he came up with this, he said, if there's such a thing as gravity, and the force is proportional to the inverse square of the distance and then the product of the mass, then you can actually derive all these Kepler's observations quantitatively. Okay? So the way I see biology is that it seems as if we're actually going through that kind of processes. Okay? In the biology literature, you will see that the quality of the data is improving, and then everything is becoming more and more quantitative. And in the end, what he learned from physics side is that whatever it looks impossible at the beginning, in the end, there are some very basic principles, okay, based on which we can actually derive and explain a lot of seemingly disparate, the phenomena. So if you're interested in this kind of things, well, I encourage you, be brave and join the forces. So with that, I will just say thank you to you and then to people who contributed to this project. And also one thing I should emphasize is that the success of our micropiston experiment really relied on this, the green cab in Cambridge, in Boston. And because everything has to be done very fast, so we prepare our microfluidic devices in our lab, and then, but soon it has to be compressed before DNA goes bad. And then the Rolang Institute, our collaborator is near MIT, so it's like two subway stops away. So to reduce time, we arranged with the green cap company. He's waiting outside, for the device to be the prepared. And then as soon as James, my undergrad student, prepares the device, he runs down and the cap delivers the device. And as soon as our collaborator receives that, he puts it on the optical tweezers. So this is part of the collaboration. I don't know whether I'm going to put it in the other co-author list. But anyways, thank you very much.